This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, you know, as all my listeners know, usually I have two authors or somebody from the publishing business on the program. But today I have a very special guest, and I wanted to give him the entire hour. So I'm going to have one guest, but at the bottom of the hour, we're going to take a little break for commercials. And also, I just want to play Devon Miller's pick for March, his book buzz that he does every month. And we'll play that at the bottom of the hour. But first, we're going to start off the hour with, my goodness, this is an exciting book for me. I really enjoyed it. A wonderful read. And Aaron Leibel. Is it Leibel or Leibel?
Leibel.
Leibel. Okay. I've known Israelis with that name, and they've pronounced it two different ways. So I just wanted to make sure.
Yes, right. You're absolutely right. In Israel, it would be Leibel. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, in Israel, I've known people who say yes. Leibel, and so I wasn't sure.
Exactly.
So it's Aaron Leibel.
Correct.
That'd be a great name if you were a lawyer.
Yes,
but you're not a lawyer. You're an award-winning author, veteran journalist. I know that you have won many prizes, including the Rockauer Prize for Excellence from the American Jewish Press, and you published in some of the most important and prestigious publications in the world. And so the new book, or the book, I don't know if it's if you have any others that we'll talk about, but the book today is Figs and Alligators, which is a great name, a really great name for a book. It's an eye-catching thing. So it's, as I said, I want to keep you on for the entire hour because it's a big story, this story of how you, an American, landed up in Israel at a very important time during Israel's development, the 70s and the 80s. So why don't you start off and tell us, how did you get to Israel?
Well, the bottom line is that I wanted to be a teacher in college, and that didn't work out. And so my wife and I had to come up with a different plan. I think that had I started teaching in college, that I would have gotten involved in the academic rat race, you know, publisher perish, and that the idea of going to Israel would never have come up. But when we had to find a different plan, so my wife, who's a very adventurous person, suggested we go live in Israel. So at first, I was very hostile to the idea. But when she persisted, I decided that, well, maybe it wasn't such a bad idea, that maybe we could go there for a year, you know, and experience living in a different place, and then come back and resume our lives. And so what happened was I began to read about Jewish history in Israel. I mean, it might sound strange that someone with all my education had never read Jewish history or Israel, but I really didn't know anything about either topic, because I had thought that what I wanted to do was to be a neutral academic researcher. And of course, if I did a research about something close to me, that would be impossible. So anyway, I started to read Jewish history, and frankly, it bowled me over. I was in awe of my heritage. And if I might say this, I think maybe that my experience might be relevant to other people as well. Because I think that it's very important, no matter if you're a Jewish person or an Irish person or a Chinese person or a Mexican person, it doesn't make any difference, that it's very important for you to learn about your background so that you'll, if you'll pardon the cliche, will be comfortable in your own shoes. And I think that's very important for self-fulfillment. So anyway, that's how we got to Israel.
Okay, well, as we might say that, you know, not getting the professorship that you wanted, it was meant to be, beshert, that I absolutely agree with you. There was a bigger plan for you. You certainly, and the plan was really big, and so you can thank your wife for it in a big way, because it's fascinating that she was not Jewish. I don't know, you know, she was not born Jewish, and so she just took this into her, and this this whole sort of passion for Israel eventually. It was meant to be. And so tell us, once you decided to go to Israel, what was the process? Because it's called an aliyah. And what was the process? How did you find it sort of mind-boggling to go through the process, just that alone?
It was a mind-boggling process, but my poor wife was the one who had to suffer through most of it, because while we were preparing to go live in Israel, I was also trying to finish my doctoral dissertation. And so she was the poor person who did most of the discussions with the Israeli representative in Washington. We lived then outside of Washington, as we do now. So she made a lot of trips, and of course we had to organize the transportation of our goods from here to Israel, which was really a pain in the butt. And we had two very small children when we left, so that was also, you know, a problem that we had to cope with.
Now, when you announced to your families, what did they think about this idea that here you were going to get on a plane and head to Israel? And for people who don't remember, 1973, when you left, and generally in the 1970s, things were really tough. There was a lot of terrorism going on. There were a lot of problems going on. So tell us, what did your family say to you?
Well, as you mentioned, Bonnie's family was Christian, so the whole thing was completely unknown to them. It was simply a foreign thing that they didn't understand. But even my family, I think, you know, my family understood about going to live in the Jewish state, about the importance of the creation of the Jewish state, but they probably felt that going to live there was for oppressed Russian Jews or Eastern European Jews or even Argentinian or South African Jews, but American Jews, not so much. So they were not wildly enthusiastic about my decision our decision.
Did the word Meshugana ever come?
Yes, it did. Yes, it did.
Yes, I would think that word was repeated a number of times. Okay, so there you are. You go through the paperwork because it's not easy, and now it is particularly not easy. Was at that point, had Bonnie converted?
Yes, Bonnie actually, as you mentioned, or I think you mentioned, Bonnie did not convert when we got married, which was really something 60 years ago, or however long we've been married, almost 60 years. So we had a hard time finding. We got married twice. So we got married once in her church, and then we had to find a rabbi to marry us, which was a very difficult thing back in 1963. but we found one. And 5 years after we got married, our first child was born. And our first child was born in May of 1967. So to people who understand history, in June 1967 was the Six-Day War. So Bonnie was home during the UN debate about the war, and of course you saw Abba Eban, one of the most articulate proponents of the Israeli cause ever. A very articulate man. So she was influenced by that, but I also think that she was influenced by the fact of the birth of our daughter, because she understood that no matter what she was, that we would be considered Jews, and so she decided the best thing for her to do would be to convert. So she converted here in Washington at a Reform synagogue. But that was technically acceptable in Israel. But she decided that she didn't want to cause our children any problems when they went to get married, and so she converted for a second time in Israel. She underwent an Orthodox conversion,
which makes a big difference in yes. Israel and yes. In general. So there you are. Tell us about the day that you got on that plane. What did you feel like? And then tell us about when you landed. How was the trip?
Well, the trip was long.
Yes.
All trips to Israel. We go back once a year to visit our children and our grandchildren. So all trips to Israel are long. But this one was especially long because, as I mentioned earlier, we had our two children, one of whom was 5 years old and one of whom was 6 weeks old. And so, you know, it was certainly trying to, you know, to take care of the two young children. But also I have to admit that I was worried. You know, neither of us had ever been to Israel, and it was an adventure. An adventure that I looked forward to, but it was also a little bit scary.
What airline did you fly?
El Al, of course.
Okay, well, not everybody takes El Al, but I wanted to know because when you got to Israel, as you get to Israel, it gets very exciting.
Right. That's true.
There's a tension in the airplane. Everybody knows it's almost a magnetic feel that it's down there, it's just below you, and you're going to be there in a few minutes. And if you're on El Al, because if you fly in those days, it would have been, I think, probably Pan Am, or I don't know who else flew into Israel in those days, but it would have been a different experience, because being on an El Al flight was something special.
Right, it was. And I mean, I don't know what airline we would have chosen. I'm sure we would have chosen El Al, but the arrangements were made through the the Israeli representative. So obviously we were going to fly El Al. But anyway, what used to happen with El Al, unfortunately, doesn't happen anymore. But I thought it was a great practice. Was as soon as the plane entered Israeli airspace, that the Hatikva, the national anthem, would be played on the speakers. You know, it really was a great feeling.
Well, it sent your heart soaring to hear that song being played. And then when the plane landed, did you kiss the ground?
No, I didn't kiss the ground, no.
You didn't? Well, so
no,
many people do, actually.
Yes, I know.
So many people do. So there you are. Oh, it's really fun when you get to Israel, because I don't think your Hebrew was up to much. So it is a different place. And in those days, it was really a different place.
Right. Right. No. So my Hebrew was non-existent. I mean, I could read, you know, as all American Jewish boys who became bar mitzvah, I had to learn to read Hebrew. And Bonnie had also learned the alphabet. And she knew a few words, but, you know, outside of Shalom, I don't think I knew any Hebrew. So, yes. So and the lady who waited on us when we arrived in the airport was annoyed with us that we couldn't speak Hebrew.
Yes. In those days, they were like, okay, get with the program here.
Right, get with the program, exactly.
Exactly. So what, they whisked you off. Where'd you go, and what was your first reaction to Israel and Israelis particularly? It's a shocking difference.
Right. So we came to Israel about something like 6 months after the massacre at Lod Airport. It was called Lod Airport when we got there. The massacre, if you remember, of the Puerto Rican nuns that had come to visit Israel. And so as a result, there was a heavy military presence at the airport to prevent any more such actions. And I, excuse me, I had never seen an armed person before in my life. And when I, you know, when we got off the plane and we started walking around the airport, there were all these soldiers with automatic rifles. And as I write in the book, if I would have had the opportunity, if it would have been like the metro system here is in Washington, where you get off one train and you go across the platform and you can get on another train and go back where you came from. If that would have been the system, I might have gotten on I might have crossed that platform and gone back, because I was, you know, here I was walking around the airport. I was carrying our younger daughter, Deborah, and Bonnie had the older one, the 5-year-old one. And it was scary. I have to admit, it was scary. But fortunately, that possibility didn't exist.
And after a while, you realize, they're on my side. they're there.
Exactly.
They're there for me.
Right.
So you, tell us about the first place that you went and just starting off with the food. What do you remember your first food that you ate there?
So the first place that we went was to what they call an absorption center that was in the hills outside of Jerusalem, to the west of Jerusalem, between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. It was a very interesting place. It was a center for new immigrants that had college degrees, okay? And we lived in a place with people from all over the world. In our building, we lived in a 4-apartment building. So in our building, upstairs was a Romanian family. Upstairs, crosswise from us, was a family from Canada. And then right next door to us was a family from Australia that came by way of Canada. And on the other side of us was a family from Argentina. So it was really an international atmosphere there. I don't remember my first meal, but I do remember that when we walked into our new apartment and opened the refrigerator, that the people at the center had left us some milk and some bread and some jam. And so we were both very impressed by their thoughtfulness.
Well, they're well organized, that's for sure.
Yes.
But do you remember your first lachmaniot?
I don't remember my first lachmaniot, but I really enjoy eating Israeli lachmaniot rolls.
Yes.
They're very good. They're very good.
They are. Well, you know, it's so interesting, those times, those years that you were there. And I'm going to have to take a commercial break. So I'm going to take a commercial break. You hold on. And when we come back, we're going to talk about further adventures in Israel. And but I'm going to lead in with here. I have a special book promo that I do every month. And we're going to do one of those in a commercial. Then you hold on, okay? Don't hang up.
Okay, sure. I won't go.
Okay.
Hey everyone, it's Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety Talk Clock children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. The month of February is also known as Black History Month, and before the month ended, a new book was released, and you probably saw it on Good Morning America. The book I'm talking about is REJ's Kinky Curly Crown, written by Ayeen Heath Drew and illustrated by Shamar Knight Justice. Having been an educator for nearly over a decade, Ayeen saw how much of an impact literature had on her children while she was in the classroom. Knowing Shamar from a school they both worked at, she picked Shamar to do her illustrations for REJ, making this book his debut as a children's illustrator and Ayeen's debut as a children's author. Based on Ayeen's niece of the same name, the book tells the story of first grader REJ. She had the perfect clothes, glasses, grades, friends, and even teacher, but the only thing not so perfect she noticed was her wild, unruly hair. When reading REJ's Kinky Curly Crown, you'll see beautifully illustrated characters in the book, all with different hairstyles along the way, and the book serves as a great reminder to embrace what makes you special. I remember my hair was becoming a little wild and curly than it should have been during quarantine, but let me tell you guys that a haircut for me was a trick to embracing my true hairstyle. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's Book Buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Z, and I am back with my very special guest today, Aaron Leibel, the author of Figs and Alligators, and now he's going to tell us why this book is named Figs and Alligators, because it is a funny story. Here he is in Israel with his young family getting used to shopping in Israel. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Well, so it's called Figs and Alligators because there's some similarity between the two words in Hebrew. It's te'enim is are figs and tananim are alligators. So obviously you wouldn't want to get them mixed up when you went to the market.
So tell us this experience of shopping in an Israeli market. It, you know, coming from America, I don't know what your supermarket was there where you lived, but it doesn't quite prepare you for shopping in an Israeli market.
That's true. One of our great joys was every Friday morning, we would go to the to the shuk, to the market, to the fruit and vegetable market, although it has a lot more than just fruit and vegetables in Jerusalem. And it's just a wonderful place. The fruit and vegetables are very fresh. The people are, especially on Friday, people are, well, there are many, many people shopping because it's they're shopping for the Sabbath, you know, for the Sabbath meal. The vendors are all yelling out their prices and how wonderful their products are. It's just a very enjoyable experience.
And then it's the food, all the vegetables, all the fruits,
right.
The tomatoes. Right. I'm not even going to start with the watermelon. Oh my goodness!
Right.
Wow, isn't it a thrill?
Right. Because Israelis' diets are so much more dependent on fruit and vegetables. I think that's the reason why. That fruits and vegetables, although they don't look as good as they do in America, I think they taste better.
Oh, yes. Yes, they taste better.
And when we finished at the market, we would go to this very, very nice restaurant and get some takeout food. We would get hummus and ground lamb and
falafel,
a few falafels, yes, so that we would bring all this stuff back so we would have a very nice lunch on Friday noon, and then we would have our Shabbat meal, which almost always included matzo balls and chicken soup and chicken, of course, and then we would have leftovers on Saturday.
So now this was while you were in your apartment in Jerusalem. Well, tell us about your kibbutz experience. How did you get to a kibbutz? Was that for the Ulpan?
No. So when we first got there, or after we were there a little while, I got a job with the Israeli Ministry of Health. I was a health planner, and I was not very happy doing that. Plus, we didn't have any family in Israel, and we were looking for sort of a substitute family for our children. And so we decided to try a kibbutz, and we visited several kibbutzim, one of which was this kibbutz Kfar Giladi, which is in a very beautiful part of Israel. It's in the Upper Galilee, between the towns of Matula, Matula is the end of Israel, literally, and Kiryat Shmona, and it's across the Hula Valley from the Golan Heights. It's just a beautiful part of the country. And we decided to move there. We lived there for 4 years. We became members of the kibbutz. It was a very interesting experience. I became an apple farmer for a little while, which is very... for an American with a PhD to be an apple farmer, it's kind of unusual. But anyway,
well, not on a kibbutz because PhDs work in the laundry too.
Right, exactly. Right.
As a matter of fact, doing the apples is much much better than landing up in the laundry.
That's true. All true.
Oh yeah. So go on. What else? Well, for Bonnie, must have been a heck of an experience because the children are with they have other children there,
right.
And then what did Bonnie? How did she take to living
right.
on the kibbutz?
Right. So Bonnie worked as the nurse in the kibbutz clinic, and when we first got there, all of the children slept in the children's houses. The theory was that adults can become more personally developed, without having to spend all of their non-working time caring for children. So what would happen would be the children would live in their houses during the day. At 4 o'clock, they would come home to their parents, and we would visit and have dinner together. And then the mothers would take the children back to their houses to sleep at night. So that worked fine for our older daughter, Lauren. But for our younger daughter, Deborah, it didn't work. So almost every evening, Bonnie would take Deborah to her child's house or to her children's house, read her a story, kiss her, whatever, and then she'd come home. And about an hour later, the woman from the there's always a woman, especially for the younger children, who spends the night in the house to make sure that the kids are okay. She would come to our apartment and say, "Your daughter is crying, screaming, not crying, screaming." So Bonnie would put on her coat, go back to the house, read Deborah some more stories until she went to sleep. This went on for several weeks, and finally Bonnie said, "That's it, I'm not doing this anymore." And so she brought Deborah to sleep at home. And this was not the first time that children slept at home on kibbutzim, but it did sort of create a revolution on our kibbutz, because shortly thereafter, all of the parents brought their young children home to sleep, and so only the older children were sleeping in the children's house.
Okay, well, so she's got a big adjustment. You've got a big adjustment. And meanwhile, how did you get into the Israeli army? There you become a member of the IDF.
I became a member of the IDF, correct. So I was drafted in the fall of 1974, and I went through basic training. And the idea when I went in was that we would, I was put in a unit after basic training with people like me who were immigrants. And the idea was that we would be non-combat soldiers. We would guard farms not far from the border. I worked the first reserve duty I did right after my basic training was I helped out in a dining room on a military base. So that was the idea, but things didn't work out that way because the border, the northern border, became very active again, and there was a shortage of soldiers, and so we were called not too long after our basic training, and we went through a program that made us into second line combat soldiers. And so from then on, at least for the next several years, I would do I was stationed on the Lebanon border, and we would do we would patrol the border on the half tracks or on trucks going up and down the road on the border. And I also spent a few times doing ambush patrols inside Lebanon, which were really scary. I had at about that time, if I can tell you, I had a very interesting a reserve duty. So this was a time in the middle 70s when a civil war was going on in Lebanon. And so the civil war was basically speaking between the Muslims and the Christians. And there were a lot of Christians living in the southern part of Lebanon, and they were cut off from the rest of the country because of the war. And so a lot of them lost their jobs. And so Israel started a program whereby the Christians who were living in the south of Lebanon could come into Israel, work on the farm or work in the towns of Kiryat Shmona or Matula, and then when they finished their work, they could go back home. They could recross the border and go back home. And they called the place where the people came in, they called it the good fence. Okay? And so one of my reserve duties I spent at the good fence. So there were three positions that Israeli soldiers manned at the good fence. And I and my fellow soldiers, we were in the northernmost of those three positions. And we spent our time either on guard duty or in a above-ground concrete bunker. And across from our bunker was a house in Lebanon. And so one of the soldiers in our unit who spoke Arabic struck up a conversation with the people across the border, and pretty soon we were in business. So we would throw the people bags of apples, cucumbers, and things, vegetables, and they would throw back bags of labneh, which is a yogurt-y kind of a dish. Both sides were pretty happy with the exchange until one of the bags of vegetables got caught up in the fence. And you know, the fence between Israel and Lebanon, it's an electronic fence, and so it's sensitive to the touch. So if a terrorist tries to get into Israel, it sets off an alarm. So the bag set off an alarm. Soldiers came down to check on the incursion, and when they found the bag of vegetables, they were not very happy. And so that was one incident that happened during this reserve duty. Another very interesting thing was one of the soldiers in our unit was from Georgia, not from our Georgia, but from Soviet Georgia. And right across the border in Lebanon, there was a road, and there were Christian officers were traveling on the road. So this guy from the Soviet Union struck up a conversation with one of the soldiers, and then he went into business. So there was the civil war in Lebanon created complete chaos there. And one of the results of this was there were no taxes collected on imported cigarettes. One of the real luxuries in Israel was American cigarettes, but they were heavily taxed in order to subsidize, to keep in business the Israeli cigarette makers, and also to prevent the waste of hard currency, the waste of dollars on a luxury like cigarettes. So anyways, so after this soldier from the Soviet Union struck up a conversation, he went into business, whereby he would buy the cigarettes from the Christian soldiers, and that had no tax paid on them, and he would resell the cigarettes to people in Israel. Uh-huh. A very lucrative
business. And yes. Meanwhile, of course, you you're still a PhD, and you're thinking there about other things. So how did you become a reporter?
Okay, so I was, while we left the kibbutz, Bonnie and I decided that it was time for us to leave the kibbutz, that we didn't want to, if we had not... we thought that there would become a time when if we didn't leave, we would have to stay there for the rest of their lives. And although we had some, you know, friends on the kibbutz, and we weren't completely unhappy, nonetheless, I don't think either of us wanted to spend the rest of our lives there. So we went back to Jerusalem, and I had a hard time getting a job, and so I went to work for a hotel. I was a night manager in a large hotel. If you know Jerusalem, it's a Jerusalem Plaza Hotel, which is in Independence Park. Anyway, I was very unhappy, and I started to freelance to write for the Jerusalem Post, and also to write for a new magazine called Newsview, which was an Israeli news magazine modeled something like Time, model on Time. And so I freelanced for several years, and then I decided that it was time for me to quit my job and to become a full-time freelancer. You know, sometimes, as I write in the book, sometimes it's good if you know what you're doing. You know, if you carefully plan your next move and everything. But in this case, it would have been very bad for me if I had known what I was getting into, and so I wouldn't have done it, and I would never have become a journalist. I was writing political opinion for the Jerusalem Post and for this magazine called Newsview, and Newsview got a new editor who was not interested in my political opinion, which he shouldn't have been, incidentally, because my political opinion was very poorly based.
Or naive, perhaps?
Yes, it was naive, yes. So he suggested that I become a reporter, that I actually do a job. And so I was not very enthusiastic, but I was also enthusiastic, about eating.
And a salary is nice.
Yes, the salary is nice. So I took the assignment, and I went to cover the creation of a new settlement on the West Bank. Now, ordinarily, I'm not very sympathetic to settlements. I would like to see peace eventually between the Palestinians and Israel. But in this particular case, the settlement was built close to a place called Herodion, which is a... the site of a castle or a palace, not a castle, a palace of Herod. And there was an American kid from Philadelphia whose job it was to guard this place, and terrorists attacked him and brutally murdered him. They counted 100 stab wounds in his body. It was really a gruesome thing. And so, in response, they set up this new kibbutz. And so, as I say, I wasn't wildly enthusiastic about settlements, but in this case, I wrote a sympathetic article. Well, I didn't know this at the time, but the editor of Newsview was a founder of a movement to unite two parts of the right-wing Likud party. And so he thought he had a fellow right-winger in me, and so he hired me when a position came open, and I started to work for Newsview. And I worked there until the magazine closed. I was there for almost 2 years, and the magazine folded. And then I went to work for the Jerusalem Post.
Well, so in this time, of course, you had another daughter, right?
Right. Oh, yes, yes.
So there you are, a young family growing up in Israel during some tumultuous years. How did the girls take to it? Well, first, your older daughter was already 5 when you got there. So,
right.
How did she take it?
Well, you know, 5 is a little bit too young to really protest, right? She just accepted it, and she completely integrated. One of the most interesting things I remember about this is going back in time, but when we first got to the absorption center, as I mentioned before, the family on one side of us was from Argentina. And I remember, like 2 weeks after we were there, Lauren, that's our older daughter, and the daughter of the family from Argentina were speaking. Now, Lauren's Spanish wasn't really strong, and I gather that the little girl from Argentina didn't know too much English. So after 2 weeks, they were conversing in Hebrew. So they, you know, for my kids, it was a... It was an easy integration.
And do all 3 girls live there?
Um, t- two of the girls live in Israel. The two who were born in America live in Israel, and the one who was the youngest one who was born in Israel lives in America.
Well, you know, it is. We talk about America being a melting pot. Israel is a melting pot with many different ingredients, and your life there is fascinating. The book, I think, is a really good read. Because it's a fast read, actually, because you can't put it down.
Thank you.
You tell so many fascinating things about Israel at that time, and it's, of course, those were the growing years. It's changed so much since then.
Yes.
It was still sort of struggling along and learning, you know, so many things, but you certainly had a fantastic life there. And I think you've done a great job with this book, and I'm really thrilled that I was able to give you the entire hour today, because I think this is a book that people will find intriguing. And I don't have time to tell everybody that, you know, you weave Israel history, Jewish history throughout the book, so people will learn a lot. And it's just one of those reads that when you finish it, you say, oh, I'm glad I read that book.
You're very kind.
Okay, now, so the name of the book, of course, is Figs and Alligators. Did you have a website you want people to go to, or are you on Facebook? You have a blog, right?
Yes, I have a blog, yes.
Okay, and how did they find it?
So they can go to, it's a blog on my synagogue's, it's a blog on my synagogue's website, which is htaa.org. And then they have to just look for Aaron's blog.
Okay. Well, Aaron Leibel, I think that you've done a great job with this book. You really give us a lot of insights into life in Israel and life for a Jewish person trying to find their way into sort of the whole thing of being Jewish and Israeli, and it's a fascinating book, and I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Shalom. Shalom.
Shalom.
Bye-bye. All right. It is a fascinating read, and those years, late 70s and 80s, which were really tumultuous in Israel, very tumultuous, lots of things happening. He's written a really fascinating book, and I really do want to, you know, recommend that book highly. One of the things, again, I want to thank so much Devon Miller for this wonderful book buzz that he did today. He is so talented, and his books, Mr. Tickety Talk Clock series, is just wonderful. And if you're looking for a gift that you want to give, or if you have some, so just feel in a mood to give, you can buy some of his books and donate them to a local hospital or local school or local organization, and let them just share the books with the children, because all of his books, there are five in the series right now, and they're so clever and so smart, and Devon is a wonderful, wonderful young man, and it's just a thrill that every month he is going to be doing a new book buzz for us. And the one that we had today, you know, it's so funny. I want to give a special shout out to my goddaughter, Kanisha. And I know she will be reading this book and just loving this book, because, you know, it's just so clever. And the illustrations are beautiful. And I hope that you will all think about, you know, buying Devon's book and also the books that he recommends every month on BookBuzz. So, again, thank you, Devon, and it's just a thrill to know you. All right. Also, everyone, thank you. Thank you for the comments about Bill Larson's appearance last week on and his discussion, and I was very happy to hear from some of you that you have learned your lesson and are not writing things on Facebook that you should not be writing, and that you are being careful, or otherwise, well, I don't know if it's good. Now you won't have to hire Bill to get you out of a mess because you've written something on Facebook that you shouldn't have, and you're going to get sued, because there are some people who are suing people. Now it's getting, people have a lot of spare time, and perhaps they notice things more than they did before, or they're looking for things to notice. So you never know, but just be careful. Do go to my webpage, which is www.radio-joyonpaper.com, and I have some of my favorite interviews up there. And, I had one of my favorite, absolutely, was my interview with Lang Martin Jr. and Kelly Woolbright. They were on the program, brilliant songwriters, and I had so much fun talking to them. And that interview is the top one on my webpage, and you really should listen to it, because we also played some of their music, and they are just fantastic human beings, and I'm very, very grateful that they were on the program. And also a special shout out to Nicholas Guy Smith, the narrator who did my Keats program. Again, thank you for the emails. I know so many of you didn't know that Keats was so interesting. And this is funny. You know, Keats was 5 feet tall. So little, great things really can come in little packages. And his brilliant writing is something that you should have a look at. So if you're looking for a poem to read, check out Keats. There are so many poems in there that you will enjoy. I don't know, in high school they ruin the poetry, but when you actually read it yourself and get into the mood, you will see that it's really great to read Keats, a brilliant, brilliant poet. And his name was not written water, and you don't want your name written water. You want to be remembered. And there is a way to be remembered. Write a book. Have it put on Amazon. It'll be there forever. 1,000 years from now, people will still be able to find it. So, because this is what I always tell you. Remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry and her Witch City Mysteries. Hello, Carol out there. Just lots of love to you, and thank you. Thank you so much, and looking forward to seeing you in May here back in the studio, I hope, because things are getting better. We hope 2021 can't be as bad as 2020. Anyway, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed. Thank you, Ed, for everything. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. And I am just like Winston Churchill. Did you know that what Winston Churchill wanted most in the world was to be a general? He never got to be a general, although he did get to boss a lot of people around. I don't know. So I am the Winston Churchill of talk radio. Okay, bye-bye now.